Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. How's your week?
It's actually really, really good. We've been away. Yeah, you've been on holiday. I've been over in France doing bits and bobs.
Yeah. I went to see Paul Weller play at Shepherd's
you did.
Bush.
Yes. And go on, tell
but
us.
He was great. He was fantastic. You know what you come away with is his voice is so good. I mean, you know, a lot of people get to his age and their voice tends to get worse, you know. I mean, or they can't reach those notes. But he's got more maturity
in
his voice.
Very careful about saying that with the sort of people we talk to.
But it's true. But but also the songs. I mean, just great songs, you know. I mean, lots of them. And that audience as well, you know, who have all grown up with him. And I was thinking about, you know, how, you know, we were all these old guys that you see out there, that I see out there. You know, I was probably standing with those old guys when they were teenagers like me, because I remember seeing the Jam a few times. But the one that sticks in my mind for some reason was when they played, well, I know why, because it was when they played with The Clash at the Rainbow. Did you go to that?
No, I didn't. No, I went to see one of their secret gigs when they played as John's Children. At the Marquee, was amazing.
Wasn't John's Children Mark Boland's first group? Wasn't it?
No, they were called no, because obviously his dad was John, wasn't it?
Of course. Was it good? that was a great gig.
Go on,
the Clash one, because it was the one with The Clash, Buzzcocks, The Jam, Subway Sect, and it was 1977, and it was at the Rainbow, and it was the one where there was meant to be a riot. It was part of the White Riot tour. I think The Clash had been were meant to play with the Sex Pistols, but the Sex Pistols tour got banned. So they then did their own tour called the White Riot Tour. But what stuck in my mind is all the chairs got ripped up and thrown onto the stage during the Clash set.
Yeah, the 70s were a great time to be in theatre furnishings. Because it's like every week the seats were being torn out of somewhere, weren't they?
They were. But I mean,
that was how you showed. I mean, what was it? Because it was a weird thing, wasn't it, with gigs in the 70s? It was a thing of that's how you. It started with the Teddy Boys in the 50s, didn't it? Which I think is a reaction to the fact they just were, you know, this keeps coming up.
And the Rock Around the Clock
music
movie,
so
right?
loud.
Rock Around the Clock.
But then there was a thing of where it was a bit like the LA police and the gangs, where bouncers with this sort of completely separate paramilitary force operating within venues that didn't really have anything to do with the venue, anything to do with the security. They were just like another tribe. It's like you had punks, teds, bouncers.
Yes, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? I do remember playing in Japan with Spandau and the bouncers being awful there. They were basically police with sticks. And as if any member in the audience stood up, they'd get whacked by a stick. And I remember saying something about it from the stage. And of course, everyone said, don't, they've got sticks, shut up. You know,
yeah.
I think times have changed, surely now.
But that was a big thing, wasn't it? Because part of the whole punk inclusiveness thing was that I remember going to see BAD in Paris. Paris was another place with terrible bouncers. And these were the thing of like the bouncers getting heavy. And it was the cool thing of like Mick Jones or whoever going, hey man, hey, cool it. Leave him alone.
That
was always the thing of the band being the peacemakers.
Yeah, well,
looking after their kids.
Hang on, let's not forget the famous Rolling Stones free concert in America.
Altamont.
Altamont, where they had Hell's Angels as the bouncers.
Yeah.
And that
Do you know, I
wasn't
saw
funny.
Something like that happen. I saw the Stray Cats at the Lyceum. And they had the same thing where they'd just been, because obviously they were rockabilly, they all had Harleys, or they were all bikers. And they got adopted by the Hell's Angels. And it seemed really weird. At the Lyceum in the Strand, it was full of Hell's Angels, and the Hell's Angels were doing the security. And everyone there was like scared to look at anyone. We were all looking at the floor. And all I could think was Altamont.
Yes, because I also have that I hate it when I'm on stage and there's the bloke with his back to you. standing right in front of the stage, you know, who's just looking at the audience for trouble. And let's face it, the, you know, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, those, that audience, the only thing they want to do is go to the toilet other than watch the band, right? I mean, it's a, they're not going to start
a lot.
Oh, we did have a fight once. We did have a fight, didn't we?
We did have a fight. Well, I missed it. I was so upset.
In America. Yeah, they were,
yeah.
Two,
I've never played in sort of fighty bands. I don't think you have either, Gary.
Two very old men started on each other. I'm not quite sure what it was about. But, yeah, so you can see bouncers have their place. I mean, I think
I want them to get people to turn those fucking flashes off.
Yeah, you don't like the lights on the camera. Anyway, we got Dave Wakeling from The Beat today.
Yes.
I bet he's seen,
Dave Wakeling from
he's seen a few
and
fights.
And general public.
Yeah.
What?
I bet he's seen a few fights from the stage.
There you go. You see, do you know what? If we'd actually thought about that a bit, we could have had a really nice little segue there.
Yeah.
Into, you know.
But we don't think about any of this.
He's a man who's seen a few fights. Talking about, he made a very interesting point in an interview I heard with him about the whole two-tone thing. And it was interesting how Madness were the one band who actually weren't two-tone.
What, you weren't on two-tone or weren't actually
No, the whole point of all those bands two-tone. Was they were black and white, all of them.
I see. Well, of course, you're right. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Nothing suspicious in
but
that.
But what's very... No. But there's it's fascinating, the whole... I mean, the whole two-tone thing. What they were is... I can't wait to talk to him, especially about the song Save It For Later, which has a pathway which goes somewhere particularly close to our hearts, Gary.
Oh, really? Like what? Where does Save It For Later? Ah, of course it does. Yes, of course.
And do you know what? What's interesting is I was just listening to it. I'm not going to mention any names, but I was just listening to it. And do you know what? It would actually sit on one of his solo albums.
You're talking about Pete Townsend, obviously.
Oh, yes. But it absolutely would sit. And David.
It would.
It's so
him. But we're going to a gig tonight ourselves, aren't we?
We are. We're going to see that great friend of the Rock on Tours and friend in life, Johnny Marr.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Supported by Gaz Coombs, who's also been on the show.
Supported by another friend of the Rock on Tours. I love referring to people as friends of the Rock on Tours. Yeah, as opposed to the sworn enemy of the Rock on Tours.
Yeah. And talking about Pete Townsend, I just want to say that I got sent a graphic novel of Lifehouse today from courtesy of Pete via his publisher, and one for you too. He sent you one as well.
A graphic novel of Lifehouse is the way to a boy's heart, isn't it?
It is. It is. So hopefully we'll get to understand it. In picture form.
No, not happening.
No, I'm looking forward to it. It's quite beautifully done.
I'd love to be the people who cracked Lifehouse. That's going to be like the people who cracked Fermat's Last Theorem. anyway.
We have Mr. Dave Wakeling, and he's waiting in the wings. Should we get him on?
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hello, Dave. So we weren't sure if you were going to come. We were getting panicked.
I had some problems logging on the bus.
Are you on the bus?
Yes. I was going to go into the venue, but they're not open yet, so...
Oh, you're on tour. Oh.
Yeah, with Adam and the Ants. We're on tour. And,
I saw Adam was on tour.
Going very well.
So where are you today?
I can't remember now. Hang on, I've got it right here.
Do you know, it doesn't make it... You can say anywhere, because we don't know.
Yeah, I could have said. We just left Washington.
Yeah.
we're in North Carolina now. Let me have a look, see here.
And is it a double bill, is it?
Yes. I mean, we're the support band, but we're going down very well. And there's quite a lot of places where we've played before. So we're in Durham today. North Carolina, which is kind of college country, isn't it? Durham, North Carolina, I think.
And how's Adam? Is he on form?
Seems very well. He's quiet, but he's convivial, seems relaxed, happy, and seems to be enjoying himself. So, you know, we did wonder, and he seems to be doing rather nicely.
Because sometimes they put you together on strange tours and they just work. Because I remember Bow Wow Wow supported you just a few years ago, didn't they?
That's right, in England.
But you think, sometimes you think, I mean, certainly in the old days, if you're a Adam and the Ant fan, you wouldn't be the Beat fan. You wouldn't be Bow Wow Wow fan. Well, maybe Bow Wow and Adam Ant. That tribalism doesn't exist in America, does it?
No, and to be honest, it didn't really at the time. Bow Wow Wow opened for a whole tour for the Beat in America in 1983, and the fans were quite happy with it. I was interested to see, because Adam and the Ant fans seem to love him so much, they don't like much else. So I wasn't sure how it was going to go, but it turned out very accepting. So the Adam and Ant fans like us, and our fans stay for Adam and the Ant seem to like that. It's built up a very nice head of steam on the tour so far. They're mainly seated venues, about 2,000, 1,800, that sort of thing. They look a little bit imposing at soundcheck. But nowadays, they're much more relaxed about it, and they let everybody stand up if they want to. So after a couple of songs, it's...
Except Margaret, she's got to stand down.
Well, later. It was her 11th anniversary of her death, wasn't it? And people were celebrating on Twitter. I can't celebrate somebody's death, you know, but it did make me want to post, lay down, Margaret, but I didn't. I got to say,
you were talking about those joint audiences. Sorry, Gary. Because this is a sort of slot that the Beat have always had, isn't it? Especially in America, of crossing all those genres. Because didn't you have a thing with, or was that general public? It was one of your songs, was sort of the most college radio played song of the decade.
They supported Queen as well, didn't they? I mean, talking about cross genres.
You know, if you could have made extra for being a good support band, because we opened for The Clash, Talking Heads, The Pretenders, David Bowie, all the big fellas, and they all liked us as an opening band, because we didn't try and drain the crowd or try and blow the headliner away, but you try and set it up so that the atmosphere is as convivial as possible. And they, all of them mentioned it, even David Bowie mentioned it from the first song. He said they were up and dancing last night. So we had an ability to do that. Also, the song seemed to work. It doesn't have to be late at night somehow. You can even get away with it in the afternoon at a festival. Somehow the syncopation of the songs helps connect. You don't need so much in terms of the lights and the drama and the focus on the stage.
Well, so what Bowie tour did you do?
No, we just did the two shows at Milton Keynes.
So did I.
Who did you play with there, Guy?
I was with Ice House.
Yeah.
We were on first, and then you
that's
were on.
That's right. Yeah. Fantastic, wasn't it? And he came in the room and said thank you and got to meet him and everything. And I'd already put my letter of resignation in under the door of the Beat office. I knew it was the last show. I had Billy McKenzie saying, "Can't get used to losing you," with me to commemorate this, but nobody else knew. Oh. And then at the end of it, David Bowie asked us if we'd go on tour with him for 3 months in America. And I didn't know what to say, because I was like, oh, my gosh. So we rushed back to Birmingham. We got back to Birmingham. And I rushed round the office and I could see the letter, and I got a stick off this through the letterbox, trying to get the letter back. And instead, and this is at 3 o'clock in the morning in Handsworth, so you don't really want to be messing around on your hands, and he's going in people's letterboxes. And so I tried to catch the letter with the stick, and the letter caught some wind and lifted and flew off all the way down, way out of my reach. And I walked home and I thought, that's probably a sign, that is then, isn't it? You know.
So that was it. You didn't do the tour and the resignation letter was read.
Yeah.
My God. That's a great story.
Ice House were offered that American tour, and I'm wondering if it's because you turned it down.
He probably says it to all the fans. He probably says it to all the groups.
It's
his introduction to young fellas.
But didn't you have a tough time?
He might have wanted the package because he said that that had been the best. Those two shows had been the best shows he'd ever done in terms of the crowd being ready to go for.
Dave,
it.
Didn't you have a bad time supporting Queen? Though I read
it wasn't as easy as we'd hoped. Because it was at their disco phase, you know, under pressure kind of vibe.
Right.
And we thought that the crowd would reflect that a bit, but it wasn't. It was still people with Levi jackets with the sleeves cut off, like punching the air, with long hair, all of them pretending as hard as they could that Freddie Mercury wasn't gay at all, which was just the oddest thing. And they didn't like us one bit, the crowd. We thought we would go down because it was dancey and they were doing that kind of disco-y vibe, but no, the people up the front were metal fans and they didn't like us one bit. And we did the English shows and then we said, we can't bear this, we can't go to Europe. We're now just going to be sworn at in languages we don't even understand. And so we said, no, we didn't want it. And we ended up losing our agent over it, I remember. We'd got it through Simon Draper was the head of Virgin at the time, and his brother-in-law was the drummer in Queen, as would, you know, often the case. So it had been sort of done through that way as well. So I managed to offend everybody that I worked with. But it was true. We were going down terrible. I was starting to get a smart mouth because I don't let people, you know, you get three or four goes but after that. You know, I'll start saying something back.
Dave, you live in America now. You've lived there a long time. And it was really, I suppose, because the beat, or what you ended up being called the English beat over there, you were embraced quite early, weren't you, by America? I mean,
I don't know whether it was messing around with American songs like Tears of a Clown or something. Our beat seemed a bit more universal. It wasn't so strictly ska or blue beat. It didn't.
Well, it isn't at all, really. It's a very sophisticated cross-pollination of...
It's a hybrid, isn't it?
...stuff that was happening at the time. Yeah. It's really funny. I always remember at the time you seemed to sit slightly outside.
A little bit. And the other thing I think was, which I didn't realise at the time, because you're not looking at it as a sociology class, but the Beat had just evolved together as a multiracial band. It was the first person we met who played that instrument. We'd never auditioned anybody else. And it just kind of fell together in a comfortable way. And I didn't realise till afterwards that the Specials, for example, the whole idea had been to present a multiracial band with a comment about people getting on together. So it was a political construct in a way, and it was very effective for it. But I'm glad, to be honest, that I was part of the Beat, which kind of just evolved naturally out of what was happening in Birmingham at the time.
Yeah.
We were lucky, I suppose, Birmingham and Coventry, because they were industrial cities or post-industrial cities at the least. And black and white people, Indian, Pakistani, they've all been working on the car tracks together for many years. And I think that had helped break down a little bit of the social alienation between people.
But in America, it was very unusual to see a band that had white kids and black kids in there.
Very unusual. We didn't realise until we came here in 1980 that radio... Yes, it was segregated, wasn't it?
It always was. You listen to white music. It's like when we had punk, basically what they had at the same time. Punk was years later, really, apart from the sort of sophisticates on the coast. They had Disco Sucks was their angry music campaign at the time.
Right. Yeah, until college radio kicked in, there was no alternative outlet, was there? I mean, funny things happened. We played Tears of a Clown at a college show, and afterwards this young woman said to me, somebody's already covered your song, you know, but it's really slow. you can't dance to it. And she'd just heard Smokey Robinson's version of Tears of a Clown for the first time. So it was sacred.
It's not you doing that. It's not a million miles away from Talking Heads doing Take Me to the River and that being kind that's of right, people's yes. gateway into that, is it? Yeah.
Well, that's true. That I mean, and later on, when you're doing your second album, there's more that sort of Afrobeat is in there as well. You know, that yes. there is a connection with Talking Heads, like, because some of that reminds me of what Byrne and Eno did on Bush of Ghosts, you know, that was yeah. which must have been influential.
Yes, that's
it was
right,
certainly
exactly.
to me.
We went down to London to the Roundhouse to make the second record, and somebody told us that there was this really great record shop. And he says, if you go in, you walk through the first room where the vacuum repair is. He said, and it opens up and there's a room full of Nigerian records. Highlight.
Oh, no, this is different. So, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we said, you're kidding. We thought somebody was spoofing us. Anyway, so we went and it was true. And we bought loads of Nico Mbaga records and Ebenezer Obey records, all sorts of stuff. And David Steele got overexcited and said, we need to go to Shaftesbury Avenue and buy loads of percussion instruments that we don't know how to play, that we've never seen.
Is that guy called Man? It's Man's Percussion or something. Is this a
yes,
Asian chap
it. It's
who
a shop
there?
With all sorts of, yeah, all sorts yeah. of stuff.
Tablas
there.
And stuff.
So we did. So we ended up at the studio with boxes of percussion stuff that we'd never learned how to play and these High Life records. And I think that was it for us. That we were more influenced by that than what was going on with Brian Eno, although I was a big fan of Bush of Ghosts. And we got to be the only band on that tour.
How was that?
It was the most amazing tour. We joked that it was the two Talking Heads goes two-tone. And we got on very well. David Byrne tried to copy Ranking Rogers' helicopter dance where he'd like dance backwards, but his arms were spinning. Each side, and David Byrne tried to do it and fell over a cable. We were all on the side of the stage and laughed about that. But he was very nice to us. They were all very nice, but he was particularly nice. He came backstage after each of us, every sound check, and we did get a sound check every time. And he said, is everything okay? Is anybody being an asshole? And is there anything I can do for you? And he said that every day.
Wow.
And there rarely was
anything,
but on occasion there was. Yeah. On occasion there was. And my wife was with me at the time, and he was wearing that beautiful white shirt, and she ended up ironing it for him. So he came back and checked on us and delivered his white shirt, which she ironed. And but he did it every day, and it was very nice. So the next time we went on tour, we had these young lads out of Athens, Georgia. And I'd been so impressed by David Byrne's act.
Yes, that's right.
After our REM sound check, I said, is there anything that you need? Is anybody being an asshole? Is there anything I can do for you?
And you got Peter Buck to iron your shirt.
Yeah, yes, that's right. Oh, no, I mean. And I got to meet up with Mike Mills. He came to one of our shows about 3 years ago, maybe a little longer. And he said, oh, do you remember when you came in and you did that after the shows? Yeah, I said. He said, oh, we did the same. So it got passed down the line.
Wow.
REM did it to their opening bands, and it was a gift initially from David Byrne to the Beat.
But that's a wonderful story because it's a metaphor for how we should all behave, right?
Yeah, it was really nice. I was so pleased. It's because, I mean, there's so many things of like obvious intrinsic value in rock that it's nice to find things that aren't actually worth a penny, but they're worth their weight in diamonds.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering if the chain actually started with David Byrne.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I suppose
if someone had done it to him,
that would be it.
My Iggy Pop did it to him. Yeah. Kind of
started with Mozart, of course.
What I was going to pitch was, do you remember when we had Johnny Marr on the show going, and we said about Johnny's playing having so much High Life style in it, and African stuff in it, and he said, it's funny you say that because I've never listened to any African.
No, I did. Yeah,
It could have come from you guys. I'm saying. I'm suggesting it could have come from the second Beat album.
I would take that and run to it. Yeah, it's he was going to play on some songs with me when I made a record the last time, and it never worked out. And I always felt that, well, that was a missed opportunity there. Because I would love, if I don't know, it would probably have helped the sales as well, but I would like to have heard what he would have played on it more for my own satisfaction.
Yeah,
he's a tremendous player, isn't he? And still,
that's amazing. We're going to see him tonight.
Oh, well, yeah, and still doing really well. That's nice to see.
The other reason you did so well in America, obviously, was because of John Hughes and your connection with the American youth movies that he was making at the time. I mean, 16 Candles. Well, I have to join you on this, Dave, because I think you and I have had tracks on... I just having a look briefly, and I saw three films that we sit together with.
Yes, that's right.
16 Candles, obviously. The SLC Punk movie, we had a track in that. And 50 First Dates.
Oh, did you really?
John Hughes.
Yes.
But John Hughes, who did Pretty in Pink and
John Hughes. Well, yeah. And actually, there's something that links us all here, which is actually one of the producers of this very podcast.
Is Tarquin Gotch.
Which is Tarquin Gotch, who's the person who's actually getting all the news on the John Hughes movies. Yes.
Who used to be your A&R man, yes, I guess, doesn't he? I mean,
he signed you, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, and manager. You know, he was the head of A&R and ostensibly signed us, although Simon Potts told a story that he'd been a runner to Radio 1. And John Peel thought he was cute, liked his Geordie accent and hard-working attitude. And we did a session, a John Peel session. And before it came out, John Peel gave a cassette copy to Simon Potts and said, "Way, hey, Hinny, go and get yourself an A&R job." And so Simon took the tape into Arista and was made up into an A&R under Tarquin's watch. And we got to visit not long afterwards, the following week, and saw Simon in his office with his cowboy boots up on his desk. And it turned out he'd only been in there 24 hours. But he already looked supremely confident as is. Tarquin was the main wheeler and dealer. And I even got to meet the guy that Tarquin had borrowed his pork pie hat off to come to the shows, because I thought he looked very smart, you know, this Crombie coat and pork pie hat. He stood out in the crowd of the A&R folks. He looked, he'd got that kind of indolent suede head look about him, like slightly malevolent. Turned out to be completely wrong. Lovely chap, as we all know.
But I'm just wondering if there's a parallel here with Gary, where Gary, you had people coming to your gigs wearing their first sash.
Of course. Yeah, their first tablecloth around their neck.
Yeah. I do think about it now, to be honest. And sometimes Adam has to walk past our dressing room on his way to the stage, you know, and you can kind of hear him coming swashbuckling. He is down the corridor. And
like Johnny Depp's dad.
Yeah, really, Johnny Depp's dad. And the makeup and everything. And I'm sitting there in like a Fred Perry shirt or a white shirt. And I was like, do you know what? That might have been a good choice. None of us guessed we were going to be wearing this clobber in our late 60s.
Football casuals. Is
yes, that's right, football casuals.
But it's funny how we all do get a bit trapped in whatever the style was when we had our biggest hit. I mean, you go to the Ivor Novello Awards, you look around the room and you can tell what year everyone has been successful, because that's the year of that haircut, right? You
know, they decided to keep their best, yeah.
You know, that's why Liam still got his 90s cut, although I think he may have just had it chopped. But I was just going to finish off on the John Hughes thing, because I don't think people realise how important it was. Next to MTV, it was the way so many British acts broke in America.
He loved,
I mean, he was making films ostensibly about white American culture, youth culture.
Yes.
And
the changes that were going on within it, which was the important part about it. Although he did it in a very kind of soapy, cutesy sort of way, he was touching upon some changes in perception that were going to run very deep in American youth culture. Because apart from MTV, and, you know, the shock value of it all and the neon and the big hair and stuff. You also saw, like, the biggest changes in stuff like racial politics and gay politics. All of a sudden, you could have friends who were different colours and that was all right. All of a sudden, you could be gay and you didn't necessarily have to get beaten up on the way home for it. And those were the things that those kids were talking about, really, wasn't it? Yeah.
And so the music to have in that was not going to be American hair metal or Bruce Springsteen, was it? Or the Geordie, you know, it's not the Geordie Shore, the Jersey Shore. You know, it was going to be British music because we somehow represented, we were ahead of the game, weren't we, in music in the 80s to what, to what America, certainly John Hughes saw that, to what American.
Well, I think he loved music, I think, that was influenced by the classic American music of the 60s, which you see in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So I think he liked anything with that kind of a groove to it. But certainly I think the English groups at the time were talking more to these levels of discontent or looking for a wider world with more equality in it. And it's a shame in a way that because the 80s were such a flamboyant success, especially in the later years of it, that they often kind of bypassed the amount of social change that was achieved during those years. Only small things, but, you know, differing attitudes to race, sexuality.
Yeah, art, and sexism.
All of that, so sexism and everything, things that our dads had said and thought were funny, all of a sudden Benny Hill wasn't funny. It was like, don't you remember that? But all of a sudden Benny Hill was offensive.
I really do think we should bring up your dad because he sounded absolutely brilliant and the most fantastic influence on you in a very often unwitting way.
Yeah, very sardonic. He could recite with passion the Rivers of Blood speech from Enoch Powell at the Midlands Hotel. He had favourite bits that he would go to. and so we clashed from a very early start, but in a good jousting sort of way. It was very much Till Death Us Do Part, and I was the socialist scarce git, you know. But he'd seen things during World War II that had made him very cynical about a lot of things, and so he would often have a drink and say things straight from the heart. And I ended up quoting him quite a lot in songs. I do remember, I think probably my best story was I'd gone round the house, we'd had a single come out, and you know what it's like the first time it doesn't go straight into the top 20. You think it's the end of the world, you know. So I'm looking a bit mopey and I'm round there, so I'm like, oh, I don't know, the song's not a hit, Dad, that's it, I'm done, you know. Hang on there, he says, wait a minute. And he comes back and he got a big load of armfuls of albums that I'd left since I'd left the house and got my own place, and he threw them all over me and he said, they're only bleeding records, Dad, nobody cares.
Right, yeah.
He gave you a hit as well, though, didn't he?
Yes. He said that he blamed the Beatles, not us. And I said, what? He'd just come back from the pub. Yes, I blame the Beatles. He said they was the first ones, thought they could do the lot, couldn't they? Yeah, we can write them, produce them, we can even do the bag. Don't need anybody's help. Yeah. He said, you never saw Frank Sinatra staying up all night writing songs, did you, though? No. He was out doing models and he got professional songwriters, Dave, Tin Pan Alley, real songwriters, not being funny, but real songwriters. He got them in and then he sung the songs the next day. Now, you know what you could sing the shit out of? This is that car get loose to using you.
Oh my god, so that was a riposte you'd do Andy Williams.
Yes. So we ended up doing it, and it turned out it suited the bass line suited it very well, you know. Bum 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 bum. It's kind of reggae-ish already. So it worked very well. So we got to the studio and then I started trying to sing it and it didn't work and I was terrible and it was getting embarrassing. It's the first album, and this is a hurdle now. And in desperation, I thought, I'll do an Andy Williams impersonation to buy time. and they'll all laugh and they'll be my friends again. And I did the Andy Williams impersonation, and Bob's heart said, "Way, hey, do you it, lad? That's it. Right, more, couple more of them." And that's what I did. So I did two more takes of an Andy Williams impersonation, and that was the final vocal.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Bob Sargent was really key to that record, those records, and because I remember he did the Haircut 100 records as
he
well.
Did, that's right, yes.
And he did have he had a sense of bringing in some of that world music. I think you sort of played marimba on Haircut 100.
Well, records, mine,
yeah, yeah, no, but that was from them, because I remember him saying what Dave was saying about going out and buying all those percussion instruments. It was that made Bob, opened up Bob to like African music and stuff, right? That's what he said.
That's
why he went and took that elsewhere.
He
really is the thread through everything, isn't he? Through the whole transition from post-punk through to the full-on 80s to the, you know.
We met him at the very first John Peel session, and he was droll, absolutely droll. "Wait, I've had them all in here," he said, "the last 2 or 3 years. We had them all in here. We had that John. We had the Sex Pistols in here last week. That Johnny Rotten, had a cup of tea with him. Very nice chap. Very nice chap. He's up to you." He says, "You've got 3 hours. You can either make a cunt of yourself or give yourself a name. So let's start the first song then."
Amazing. And that did have that first album. I mean, that just had some amazing songs on there. Were they songs that you'd written over the, you know, since you were a young man?
There were a couple of songs that had been written earlier that never made it on the record, never made it till the third record, Save It For Later and End of the Party. But most of the songs had been written fairly contemporaneously. There was nothing that had been saved. And like the punk had come on and New Wave had come on, and Save It For Later and End of the Party were deemed as Old Wave Dave. They were voted Old Wave Dave. And so they were on the first record. They weren't punk enough. And so I tried again on the second record, and no, they were still too Old Wave Dave. And on the third record, Simon Potts put his foot down and willingly was bribed by the people in the band who didn't want the songs on the record. he paid them.
Let's talk about Save It Till Later, because Save It For Later.
Yes,
because,
please.
Oh,
yes,
my
please.
God. You know, I mean, we are massive Who fans here on that
yes.
show. And of course, Pete, to have had Pete Townsend recover one of your songs, I mean, that must have felt incredible.
It was surreal. Somebody passes me the phone, the same woman who ironed David Byrne's shirt, and said, "It's Pete Townsend." And I said, "Well, of course it is. He phones Saturday morning about this time every week." "Oh, hello, Pete." And I swear, I thought it was Mickey Billingham, the piano player from General Public, previously in Dixies. I thought it was him. It seemed like his sense of humour at the time. But it turned out, no, it was Pete. So I was like, nice one. "Hello, Pete. All right, come on in." And he's like, "Oh, hi, Dave. It's Pete Townsend here. I'm sitting with Dave Gilmore. We're trying to play your song Save It For Later, but we can't work out the tuning." And it turned out what I'd done, I was trying to play along with the John Martin record, and I was tuning my guitar until I thought it sounded...
That's very Old Wave Dave.
Very Old Wave Dave. you know. But I mean, Space Junkies, they're eternal, aren't they, really? And I'd got it more or less, but it wasn't quite right. And it turned out that I'd tuned the G string up to an A, and it should have been left. So it should have been Dad Gad, and I'd done Dad Ard. A-A-D. D-A-D. A-A-D. Pretend
you're... Of course,
you're...
now you tune it that's to a, Old
that's
Dad.
That's an IKEA bookcase, isn't
yeah,
it?
Never...
Old Dad is the tuning we use now. Sure.
Never tune your G-string up to an A. And that's where it had gone wrong. And so they thought it was Dad Gad, but then it wasn't sounding right. And so off they went. I start thinking more commercially at this point. I've got over the shock of Pete Townsend and Dave Gilmour phoning me up. Now I'm thinking they're covering my song. Well, that's publishing, isn't it? I'm like, hang on a minute. This is a better Saturday than I imagined. And then he said, it's for a Nicaraguan earthquake, a volcano. It's a
volcano, yeah, the volcano.
Nicaraguan volcano appeal. And I said, they've got enough volcanoes, Pete. They don't need any more. They just had one go off.
And, dear.
You know, he let that one go. He probably realised I was just, the publishing reality was just starting to sink in.
Because he did a beautiful version, and what's so great about it, I'm sure Guy agrees with me, your lyrics aren't that dissimilar to the sort of lyrics that he would write. No. You know,
we actually discussed this earlier, Dave. That song would actually sit on one of, not a Who album, but it would sit on one of Pete's solo records.
It suits him, doesn't it? It does suit him.
It really does.
Do you know what I did see floating around, and I haven't seen it for ages, but I'm sure it's still about, is him and the Ox playing Save It For Later together, just the two of them, for 5 minutes at the sound check in Las Vegas.
Wow. It's on YouTube. Is it on YouTube?
I don't know. You know, I haven't seen it for ages, but it's thunderous. Wow. If you could imagine the Ox at his best. Amazing. It sounded absolutely superb.
The Pearl Jam have covered it.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was the oddest thing. I was working for Greenpeace, and Pearl Jam agreed to do this song for a solar-powered album we were doing about global warming. So long as I had to find a woman who'd be willing to sing it, because this song that they'd got was written from a woman's perspective. So we asked Chrissy Hynde, and she said yes. So on the strength of that, they agreed to record it. And we went up to Spacewalker Ranch, a mobile studio, and we took our solar generator to provide the electricity. And they started recording it, and I was like, hang on a minute. I know this song. And a couple of takes in, I looked at Stone Gossard, and I looked at him, and he nodded. And I waited till the next break, and he came over. He said, yes, what are you thinking? You're right. He said it was Eddie's favourite song when he worked at 91X. I was like, oh, I thought so.
Wow.
I'm working for Greenpeace. I was very charitable at the time. It's all for the dolphins, all to be good, you know. Then, sadly, Chrissy Hynde couldn't do it. She dropped out because she was recording a beautiful acoustic album called Live from the I Love You with strings and her acoustic guitars. Beautiful record. And she couldn't be disturbed, so she couldn't do it. So the record never ended up being done for Greenpeace. And then, very kindly, they sent us all the money it had cost. They sent us the full amount of everything it had cost Greenpeace to record it and all of that, which was nice of them. And then they brought it out with Eddie singing the lyrics. She smiles and says she's in love with him. So it sounds all right with a bloke singing it, after all. Not too bad. And now, live, they play a segue of Save It For Later when they play Better Man. So I do one of Better Man in the middle of Save It For Later. Not on the Adam and the Ants tour, but I do it sometimes, especially if we're in Seattle or Portland.
Of course.
And I've often wondered, I mean, I hope I could resist, but, you know, if I ever end up destitute and homeless, I might call them and ask them about that publishing one day.
What happened? Because I think it was all, you know, I'm just going to go back to that period in the 80s when the Beat finished and General Public started. I remember thinking it was a strange kind of leap and wasn't quite sure why it had happened, because you were still with Roger. you know, so it was always you two anyway, it felt like. And why you needed to change the name and why that happened. I know
well,
the
music. It was the oddest thing, really. It was a number of missteps for many of us. A bit like a triple jump. If you set off on the wrong foot, it doesn't really matter how much you wiggle your legs in between. You're going to land on the wrong foot as well. A couple of the band wanted 2 years off. They didn't want to do anything. Although we were just about to sign a deal with Virgin, it kept falling further and further away. And Tarquin was trying to be the manager at the time to see if he could at least liaise it. But they were adamant, and they were right, because they took 2 years off and started Fine Young Cannibals. So they did follow their muse in that. You know, there was much talk that it was more planes than buses nowadays, that people wanted to just be able to walk to the shops, buy what they needed for dinner, go home, cook it, and not do anything else, and not have to do an interview with somebody from Switzerland. And to live a normal life and write songs about normal things and not write songs from the perspective of the back of a tour bus barreling down Rock and Roll Boulevard. And there was a general distaste that sadly all that we'd become was a rock and roll American stadium band. You know, our 15 minutes had passed in England and that we'd just become a stadium band. And so it was put to us that me and Roger might like to do something by the record company. And I said, yes. I'd first suggested David Steele. I said, well, he's the genius, isn't he? He's the Mozart. He said, oh, yeah, but he's the one who wants the 2 years off. That's no good. So, Virgin were convinced that me and Roger had some juice left in us as an act.
The beat, you felt that you had to change the name. I mean, I guess it was
Feel we were leaving, because there was also questions about whether to get rid of the drummer or not, which I've never spoken about, but he's died now, so I suppose I can. And that was another one of the stipulations. And I thought it was easier to jump ship and just leave rather than have to deal with sacking the drummer, which I didn't want to do. And interestingly enough, they carried on then, ostensibly as the beat, but only for a minute. And then they parted ways with the drummer and started off as two men, a trumpet and a drum machine or something, which turned into Fine Young Cannibals. So it was all on the cards. You know, they did want 2 years off and they weren't going to work.
But did leaving give you a sense that you could change the music a little bit, or was having Roger with you always, did that always pull you back into having to make a particular style of record that you couldn't evolve out of?
Well, funnily enough, me and Andy were far bigger reggae fans than Roger when we started the beat. He was much more a pure punk. He was the black punk of Birmingham. And his love of reggae developed from listening to our record collections, basically. He was far more the three-minute pop punk single. And so as general public came, he was actually wanted less and less to do with reggae. He didn't want to do toasting anymore, for example. He only wanted to do singing. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's a shame, isn't it? Is he one of the best toasters in the world? But not necessarily one of the best shots.
Do you know what?
But he wouldn't really do it. He did a bit.
In terms of your musical direction, and this is really interesting, something that struck me earlier from listening to Tenderness and now hearing that, like, your last gigs were those Bowie gigs. Because what I was thinking earlier was, wow, isn't that funny? This actually sounds like Let's Dance. That, not the song, the album.
It's yes,
that
that's
kind
right.
of feel and that sort of fidelity. It's almost like that's what rubbed off on you.
Yeah, a kind of, and we went on as general.
Modern Love, in fact, there's a Modern Love vibe.
We went on to do a tour with Hall & Oates and had the same kind of blue-eyed soul connection, I think. We toured with them south, which was.
Because in a way, what you were coming out of, what your background, what feels like, and you're there you are wearing the Fred Perry shirt now, is Tamla Motown. It was soul. Yes. It was, I mean, you're a little bit older than us, Dave, and it seems like your connections may have gone a little bit into the old mod culture.
Yes, they were, because that was the top of the pops for me in black and white. And you'd have the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, the Four Tops, and Diana Ross all on the same show. And we grew up not realizing that there was anything special about that. It was just that there was only one TV show and one radio station, so everybody had to go on the same one. And we didn't realize, frankly, how lucky we were that we got such a wide education on music, because Motown, Tamla Motown, was the cream of the crop on the English charts at the time. And it went even across, I think, over and above the mod youth culture. Motown was one of the few musics that all the mom and dads seemed to love it too. You know, you would often hear it played in older people's pubs.
But you're also from the home of metal.
Yes, my first two bands was two local up-and-comers, Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. That was like the first, the one Saturday and then the next Friday. And I got to see Hawkwind, I think, the same weekend as one of them, with Stacia.
We were talking about gigs we'd been to earlier before you came on. And I just, were you at the Hyde Park Rolling Stones show?
No, but I did go to the Blind Faith one. We hitchhiked down from Birmingham, which was quite good, really. I think we were only about 14, and we did a great trick pretending we were all at each other's houses, you know, for the weekend. We managed to get away with it and get home. So I didn't go to the Rolling Stones one. I wished I had, but we did go to the Blind Faith one, which was a big occasion. But I don't think it turned out to be the musical revolution that people were perhaps hoping for. We went to visit,
you know what,
because of our local hero, wasn't it? The Steve Winwood, Brummy lad.
Yeah, Birmingham lad, yeah.
Yeah.
And a great soul singer too. I mean, first blue-eyed soul singer, probably.
Yes, probably, yes. I think so, you know. It must be something in the water.
Do you know, what I was wondering if, because Birmingham is so close to your heart, and a lot of your songs that you wrote back in the 80s were very much about growing up in Birmingham, and I wondered if living in America for so long had sort of changed or made it harder for you to write. But then you brought a beat album out in 2018, didn't you? And I'm sure it's on that album. There's an amazing song on there called Never Die, and it's, you know,
yes,
you're still writing great songs, Dave. I mean, that is a really truly brilliant song.
I've got a few more ready, you know, but yes, you've got to go through loss and grief, haven't you, and see how it comes out at the other end. It was reflections on the death of both of my parents, but also my son, as a teenager, was hit by a car in London and was unconscious for many months, and some of the song was written in the ICU, holding his hand. In fact, there's noises from the ICU in there. A bit weird, but there's the sound of the sounds on the monitors. And
is he okay now?
No, but he's with us. He's with us, and he's cogent. But he didn't recover physically as much as we'd hoped.
Sorry to hear that.
He's still sarcastic, and he always has something cruel to say when I see him in Brighton. And I mentioned it last time. And I said, I just wish, even if you could just make it up, you know, just say something about, I'm a fabulous father, you know. And he spells things out on a plastic board with a rather shaky hand. And he's like, you are, and it was like, F-A-T, you are fat.
Oh.
Fuck you too.
Oh, they never change.
So definitely still my son then.
Some of the
talk was about that, and had it has a sample of London Ambulance Rain 1963 going across the screen. So it was meant to be a bit of a story about it, but at the end it's meant to be kind of redemptive, that life does go on in all sorts of different ways, and that you have to be up for the next challenge, you know. But I would say songwriting becomes more difficult now. Things are everything's black and white when you're young. It's obvious. And you haven't been solid. Mm-hmm. You haven't been let down. You haven't learned that human nature can be very cruel. And so you're more open and giving about stuff. You can become a little bit more guarded as you get older. Been burnt a few times. Burnt your own fingers a good few times, probably. So it makes you a bit more guarded. But I have written a few songs. And my current lineup in the band is just superb. One of the best I've ever had, if not the best. I started working with a new drummer, a Berkeley graduate. And then I needed a keyboard player. And he said he knew somebody. And I spoke to him the next day. He said, oh, yeah, I sent him it. He's learnt it. He's ready to start. I said, what do you mean he's learnt it? He said, well, he just transcribed it, wrote it down. He's learnt the parts. He's ready to start. And so we did, and he did. He knew all the songs. And so now... Basically, most of my band are Berkeley alum. They're all in their 20s.
So you're basically Steely Dan now.
It's either that or it's Sting's first solo record. I've gone a bit Blue Turtles.
No one's doing the helicopter dance.
No, not quite. So it has made me think, gosh, I could record some of these new songs and enjoy it. I might talk to the people at Rhino who are bringing out the Beat Records, because there are some good ones. I had thought, though, I read that when you're a teenager, the songs that you like then affect you so emotionally that you have a connection to those songs forever. It does something that ingrains in you.
Yeah.
And they found out scientifically now, which is what we've probably known all along. And so because of that, even so I had my new record out, I would still sell more of the old records at the merch counter than the new one. And in many ways, my fans, after 45 years, they've got all the emotional connections they need. In fact, new songs only complicate the matter.
So you've got these reissues happening, haven't you?
Yes, and they're doing them very nicely. I mean, they're really bringing them out beautifully. The sleeves are gorgeous. The mastering is superb. They're really brought out to the top quality you could imagine. It feels kind of precious when you hold one. They've made a lovely job, which I know Rhino is famous for. And we're sort of advertising. It's a bit awkward for me. I just did a public service announcement for a record store that I'm visiting in Houston on 420 for Record Store Day. I thought I've agreed to do one to see how it goes. I haven't agreed to any more yet. We'll see how I like it. But then I just had to do a radio spot for it, and I'm telling everybody to make sure they check in their tote for the lucky ticket number, because one of them's going to win an album. And I started to feel a bit whorish at that point. I like making records, or I did. I don't really like selling them, you know. I never wanted to work.
Yeah, and now there is all of that now. Social media, everyone's going to do everything.
It's all about that. It's all about that.
There's no mystique anymore.
I mean... No.
It's changed
Rolling
so
Stone
much.
Did an unboxing video. I mean,
it's changed so much that you feel silly, like a granddad. I said, we're doing this tour. There's thousands of people every night. I said, I haven't got any flyers or any posters that even say these records are being re-released. And they looked at me like I was nuts. What are these flyers that you speak of? You know, what they want from me is they want 30-second clips that they can put on TikTok, because over the next 5 years, that will affect the Spotify numbers so much that we'll recoup whether we sell any records or not.
You are a QR code, Dave. You're a QR code.
Yes.
You've reduced.
Yes, it's so different, you know. I felt silly. Where's the flyers?
Listen, thanks so much for coming on. Give Adam Ant our best and tell him that he should do the Rock on Tours, because we're worth talking to.
Yes, he'd like it.
Is Marco with him? Is Marco in the band? No. Sorry. All right.
No, got to bring that up. Hello. Well, you can save that for your Adam interview. I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
But good luck with the show tonight.
He seems in great spirits, and he's singing nicely. He seems to be enjoying himself, and the tour has developed a head of steam. To start with, he was a little distant and standoffish, and that made both parties a little, when you're a jet, kind of vibe.
Yeah.
But now that's all melted down. Everybody.
When you're an ant.
Yeah, when you're an ant. I still want it. That's the only thing I would ask in an interview. I never got it. What's it got to do with ants? What's the Burundi beat got to do with ants? I know it was a good joke on that show, right? Adam Ant. Oh, you're youngsters. You don't remember.
No, we remember that.
I do know a great story, though. And it's Steve McLaughlin again. A friend of mine who told about it, going to see Adam and the Ants at Cardiff University or somewhere, some university. And there was a fire and they were trying to get everyone to leave.
Yeah.
And eventually the safety officer came on stage and said, they won't listen to us. Adam, you've got to, they'll only listen to you. We need to get everyone out of the building. And so Adam Ant, apparently, maybe you should ask him, apparently said to the audience, hi, this is an ant request to ant people.
And they cleared the building.
And that got them out.
They were fire ants.
Yep. If I see him at soundcheck, I'm going to ask him if he can do that for us tonight.
Yeah. All right, Dave, thanks so much for coming on.
A real
thanks
pleasure.
So much, Dave.
Absolutely lovely. I could talk all day, as you can see. But thank you very much. Really appreciate it. My love.
All right, all the best.
No, really nice, Dave. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye, Dave.
That was all right. It was good. The nice, wonderful, rich voice he's got, isn't he? You know,
lovely,
great
rich voice. And I like that sort of. That was a real chat. There was no chronology. That was just a chat.
It was really nice.
And a lot. I think, and I do think, as is our want, I think we got some stuff there that you don't usually get from him.
Yeah, and listen, go and listen, because that Pete Townsend version, I'd forgotten. I remember listening to Pete singing that song on. There's a live video of him.
Yeah, Deep End Live. And he actually tells the story about calling, and he plays you the tuning.
But I remember hearing that separately, like as a cut, and thinking he'd written it. You know, cause forgetting that it was the Beaks. It's such a Pete sort of chord sequence as well, isn't it? You know, but what an honour, God. Do you think you'd ever cover one of mine?
I'm quite disappointed. I'm going to have a word with David because I'm quite surprised with his ear.
Because David was in the band at the time, wasn't he? David was in the band.
Yeah, David was in the band at the time. I'm quite surprised that David didn't work out what that tuning was because not much gets past it.
Yeah, it's tricky. Anyway, listen, I'll see you in a bit because we're going to go to Hammersmith.
I'll see you in the foyer. And I'll have a zero beer, please.
Me too. All right, all the best. And it's a good night for me.
And good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.